the reason why. So I request all of you to bring your palms together to make our veneration to the Perfect One, the Supremely Enlightened One, the Undefeated One, the Infinitely Victorious One. Reminding ourselves that it is in His footsteps today we have the privilege and honor to follow with clarity and steadfastly we walk towards the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, which lay clearly set in front of us thanks to the great master and all the teachers who have followed since. As we bring our palms together in veneration, let us also remind ourselves that this is a moment that we take to renew our pledge of allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, reminding ourselves that the Buddha represents the ultimate destination, the Dhamma, the path and Sangha, the practice. And so, with all that in mind, let us take this moment to chant the Namaskara, observe the precepts and commence today's proceedings.
Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas. Namo tas bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhas.
How are we all doing? Is the Dhamma working its magic on you? Are you healing? And how's that feeling? Once the Dhamma, let me put it this way. As the Dhamma has begun to have its effect on you, people around you will feel less threatened by your presence. They will enjoy your presence. They will like to have you around them. They will want to have you around them. And they will wish for that. At the beginning, you will have the spiritual maturity and the internal strength to contain any negative emotions within yourself and not let it out on others. And once you are able to do that, others will not be hurt by the things you say or the things you do. But it will still hurt from within. You will still feel the hurt within. It will still be, you will still feel the storms, the internal storms of those emotions within you. But that comes second. When you become someone who at no cost, or at whatever cost rather, will refrain from imposing, inflicting pain on others, that virtue itself will pay back. It will pay its rewards, and you will be able to then settle those waters, settle those storms, calm those storms within you. It comes as a gift for what you give to others. There's a saying that you are not hurt for your anger, but you are hurt by your anger. So anger, for example, because anger is a very common enemy, one that I think there's no one in this room who can say, anger, what's that strong in us? I don't know what you're talking about. We've all been there. We all know what that feels like. Anger is a very common emotion. But just because it's common doesn't mean it's correct. Doesn't mean it's right. It's a disease of the mind. It's an extension of dvesha. of the three roots of all defilements, which are raga, dvesha, and moha. Now I have to travel with luggage. So many props to help explain the Dhamma. Much of this is actually not my doing, but people amongst yourselves. All I have to do is make a request and you will run to the other side of the world if need be to bring some and fetch some of these things so that the Dhamma can be explained. So that everyone and anyone can understand. The Dhamma is not complicated, it's not complex, but it is subtle. It's just like threading a needle. And someone tries to thread a needle and they can't get the needle through the, or rather thread to the eye of the needle, and you're the one observing, what do you tend to say? Come on, can't you even do that? Right? And you usually tend to offer your assistance. But then, when you try and do it yourself, then you realize that it's quite a subtle thing to do. But it doesn't look complicated. And it's not. The Dhamma is not complicated. It is well within the means of Sunita and Sopaka. They were not educated. They were probably the most uneducated people back then. So education is not what we need to understand the Dhamma. But wisdom is what is required. Wisdom is your ability to understand some basic concepts and apply it to your life. And like we discussed last week, then there's practice. There's no substitute for practice. So I can't, and no one else can do that part on anyone else's behalf. It is we ourselves who have to take responsibility for that. So at moments where you feel anger, where do you feel anger? Is it after you go to sleep or before you wake up? After you go to sleep or before you wake up? When? These are not the times where you feel anger, right? You feel anger after you get up and before you go to sleep. So these two moments are critical moments of your life because this is when all those emotions take over. And you are at the mercy of your practice. Actually, that is all it is. Each and every one of us are at the mercy of our practice. To whatever extent we have developed ourselves through our practice, to that extent we are strong. Mentally, we are strong. Many people put a lot of time and effort to strengthen their physical bodies. And there's nothing wrong in doing that. It's perfectly fine to do that. But if you don't do the same with your mind, ultimately, the simplest of things can knock you down. Just imagine a strong man, 6 foot tall, well built, but he can't control his temper. How can he protect others? How can he protect others from himself? One might think, you know, if you are strong, you are muscular, you can fight, you can protect others from yet others. But how do you protect others from yourself? You understand the irony there? If I'm strong and muscular and I can wield a weapon, if I'm trained in the martial arts, I can protect you from others. But if I'm mentally weak, if the slightest thing and I get annoyed and I'm easily irritated and I have a short temper, then how do I protect you from myself? Who hurts you the most, strangers or people you know? There you go. Try working that one out. Who are you most hurt by? Strangers or people you know? The people you know. That is because they don't know how to protect you from themselves. Very seldom do strangers hurt you. I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen? You go to the shop and the shopkeeper shortchanges you. And then you demand for the right money and he says, no, I gave you the right money. I mean, that's about the worst that can happen. People don't just come randomly come up to you and slap you or shout at you, right? They don't. That doesn't happen. Unless, you know, you're going through a really bad time of misfortune, right? So it doesn't typically tend to happen. And even when a stranger does something wrong, they typically tend to apologize, don't they? Like if you bump into someone on the street and say, I'm sorry. People just automatically, they just apologize. But sometimes the people we know, they deliberately hurt us. Forget an apology, they deliberately hurt us. So now put yourself in their shoes. So let me put this question to you back to you then. I asked you a moment ago, who are you hurt by the most, strangers or people you know? And you unanimously gave me one answer, that is, the people that we know hurt us more than strangers, Swami answered. Okay, now, then think about the people around you, the people that you know, the people who are known to you. Who do you think they are most hurt by? Strangers or? Strangers or? You, of course. Who do you think they are most hurt by? You. So to protect them from strangers, to protect them, for you to protect them from strangers, here are some things you can do. Get yourself a T-56. Or at least an air rifle. Find yourself a weapon. And keep it somewhere, easily accessible, maybe under the bed, in case. I had a friend whose father, so he loves his children, and so what he used to do is every night he walks, goes around the house, locks all the doors and windows, and then he has a little, not little, it was a, it's not even a stick, it's more of a, I don't know what you call them, a baton, yes, a baton, a long baton. He would keep it under the bed. So this man, he wanted to protect his children, he wanted to protect his family. But he was short-tempered. Just think about that. He had a very short temper. So now the children, who do you think they feel more threatened by? The burglar or the father? On an average day, a typical day, a week, right? Who do you think they're most hurt by? The father. Do you think the wife feels safe at home? She probably feels safe out. Because how often does a burglar come and, you know, because a burglar wants to take things in the house. So they break in. So if you slept outside, you'd be fine. But this man, he kept this baton to keep his family safe. In some countries, you can keep a pistol. Right, in a drawer next to the bed. You've seen this in movies and so on. Or you keep it under the pillow. In case it's the person sleeping next to you that annoys you. So, a weapon. If you keep a weapon, you can protect others, people that you love, from strangers, from others, from their enemies. But how do you keep the people that you love safe from you, from when you become the worst version of yourself? The only way to do that, ladies and gentlemen, is to stop becoming the worst version of yourself. Give yourselves a target. Set yourself some goals, which I'm sure you do in other areas of life. Professional goals, career goals, education goals, right? financial goals, right? You have them, don't you? Now we are slowly moving towards the end of the year. So it will be a time in a couple of months for you to check your achievements against the goals that you set at the beginning of the year. How have you fared against those goals that you set for yourselves? I hope amongst them you have some goals, some personal goals. Personal goals in the sense of, I want to be less of a threat to my family. I don't want to get as angry as I normally tend to do. I want to be at peace, and I want to help others be at peace. Chances are, people at home, they fear you, and that's not good. If the people who live with you fear you. Now when I say this, you can think of someone else perhaps. Maybe it's not you, maybe it's someone else. Maybe it's your other half. Maybe it's one of your children at home. They're always short-tempered, always on edge. The shortest thing, the smallest thing can trigger them. I know children who are always... I know children who are always annoyed, angry, and take it out even on their parents. Some shout at them, scream at them, yell at them, hit them. Some are very dangerous. I've heard of some children like that. When I used to go to school, I had friends who were like that, but I didn't know how to help them back then. They were a threat. And sometimes the parents, now even since I became a monk, sometimes parents come and ask me, Swami Nansa, we feel that the last thing we should be doing is keeping our son at home, because he doesn't know that, once he gets mad, he goes angry, he forgets that I'm his mother. He forgets that I'm his mother, and I'm worried that one of these days he might strike me, and what's worst, he might pick up a weapon and attack me, and if in the process of doing that he ends up killing me, Swami Nansa, I can be okay with that, but I know what that's going to do to my son. He's going to make a mistake that he cannot recover from. So how do I help him? See, anger is something that if you don't learn how to, I can't use the word manage, because anger management is not what we teach. Anger management is not what Buddhism teaches. It's anger eradication. You can go to counseling or some kind of therapy and learn how to manage your anger. There are many anger management programs out there. But anger eradication can only happen, as far as I know, in the sasana. The thing is with anger, the more you get angry, the more you tend to get angry. Because every time you get angry, you push your boundaries. That's what happens. And every time you get angry, your mind becomes weak. People think the opposite happens. People think that when they get angry, they are stronger inside. And sometimes people even use anger to display their prowess, their power. And people think that that is a sign of power and authority. Some people are just constantly angry. I don't know if you've come across people like that. They're just constantly angry. Sometimes it is not that they're actually angry inside, but they try and maintain that sort of persona. Right? You know, I'm angry, all right? Don't mess with me. I'm easily angered. So don't mess with me. It's like they're always growling. It's that beware. These people need help. They need help, ladies and gentlemen. They need help. An angry man is a man who needs a lot of help. Because that mind is very weak. That's what you must understand. Very weak. They're so weak that they need anger to strengthen themselves. That's what happens. Emotionally, that's what they do. They charge themselves up with anger. It's like a deflated balloon. That's what their minds are like. To give you the analogy, it's like a deflated balloon. So a deflated balloon is useless, right? You can't do anything with it. So what do you have to do? You blow it up. And when it's blown up, it looks big. And when it's big, it has a presence. It's noticeable. People take account of it. So when people's minds are weak, when the people's minds are so fragile, and they think so low of themselves, what they tend to do is, because they have little capacity to express love, kindness, compassion, and give protection in that way, what they tend to do is, they blow themselves up with anger. So when you see an angry man, that's what you got to understand. Look at them and study them. Use what you have learned through the Dhamma to look at them and study them. See what they are doing to themselves. They're blowing themselves up. Like a furnace that you keep blowing. They just keep blowing themselves up. And that's how sometimes the balloon, like if you keep blowing a balloon, what happens? It bursts, right? Sometimes people get so angry that their anger comes to a point where it's uncontrollable, and then either they collapse. They'll either collapse or they'll just drop unconscious. That's what happens. These people need help. These people, not you people, right? Am I right? You don't get angry, do you? No. No, Swami. No, so you don't get angry, Swami. No. We are good Swami. No, so. I know, good Swami. Good, so I am good Swami. No, so. I'm asking you. So the Dhamma is here to heal you. Let the Dhamma heal you. And the last thing you should do when you're in front of an angry man is make them even more angry. And that tends to happen if you also get angry. Then you start playing tennis. Verbal tennis. That happens because you rebound. If you do tit for tat, then each feeds off the other. That happens very, very soon. And in a very short period of time, you can see sometimes how something that could have ended with a short disagreement, right? Something that could have ended with just a quick exchange of words, develops into a tsunami. Has that ever happened? At your neighbor's? Not at your place, I'm sure. Now, if you live in a flat, for instance, you've got to be careful. Because you're going to don't put on display that, at least then don't dress like that on a Sunday, because people will know that you're coming to Rajagiriya. If you live in a flat, right, you share a wall with your neighbor, and then once you start screaming, then they will know. Sometimes you may hear your neighbors screaming, shouting at each other, throwing things against the walls, right? Throwing things and crashing things and all sorts. It's embarrassing, right? That's only because my minds are not strong. So this mental stamina, it develops and grows the more you feed it the Dhamma. You have to feed it the Dhamma, and then you have to practice the Dhamma. That's how your mental capacity to tolerate can grow. So you ask yourself, What is your mental capacity? How much can you tolerate? To be able to tolerate is a virtue. The Dhamma helps you do it better. The more Dhamma you understand, the better you become at tolerating. And the more you tolerate, the less there is war at home or at the workplace when you're amongst others. Sometimes what people tend to do is when they know that it's now getting to a point where they're going to start saying things, they will exit, right, that situation. They'll go in and close their door, lock themselves in the room, and they will stay in there until they calm down. That is an anger management technique. No harm in doing that, but it's still an anger management technique, not an anger eradication technique. To eradicate your anger, you have to understand the Dhamma before you get angry. So this sermon would be useless to you when you're angry. So if you're angry right now, I don't know why you would be, but if you're angry right now, then this sermon would do little to help you with that. The Dhamma is best consumed when you have joy in your heart. It's best consumed then. When you have joy in your heart, that's the best time to consume the Dhamma. I can hear some of you saying, Swaminathan, that's why we keep suggesting to give the sandwich before the sermon. To have joy in your, not in your belly, joy in your heart. So, if you are someone or if you know someone who gets angry, or who is angry all the time, who needs help, then let's learn some Dhamma that will help them to free themselves from that mental illness. Shall we take an example and talk through that? How you can be free from anger through your understanding of anicca, dukkha and anatta? That might be a useful thing to learn, not for you, I know, sure, but for others. You remember this so that others can learn from you. Right, so let's take an example situation. Let's just say, see, I have to remember now. I have to go back a long time into the past before I can remember the last time I got angry. So I'm trying to remember when did that happen. And so I have to bring an example from back in my past. You've never been angry, so you wouldn't have any example, of course. You're better than me in that regard. Okay. A time you can get, you might find yourself being angry, or that you might get angry, is when someone insults you. Someone says something that you find offensive. That's an example. Or someone breaks a promise. And that promise doesn't have to be a big promise. Sometimes it's just something that they promised to do. Something they committed to doing it, but they haven't done it. Can often happen at the workplace. Maybe there's a deadline of some sort and you wanted someone to get something done for you, and you come back into the office and you realize that that was not done. So now you have to answer up to your boss and then your subordinate to whom you delegated that task, they haven't done it. So now you're in a rid of a difficult situation. So then that can trigger anger. Now I remembered one. Long time ago, I used to drive a car. I had a car. And so where we used to live, we had reserved parking spots. You see where this is going? Yes. They were reserved. Or so I thought. So they had the flat, now the house number printed. So you could see it from, even if you were in a helicopter, you could see it. But some people, I don't know why you call them people, but some people, they feel that just about anyone can come and park their car in my parking spot. And it gets worse. Sometimes they block the driveway. Then what do you do? Right? So here's the house. There's a driveway. Here's the main street. Other houses. Now, they can park here. They could easily park there. It's free parking as well. But they choose to park here. And I've just gone out to run an errand of some sort. And now I come back home. Right? Dinner's ready. And I want to go get my dinner. And what do I realize? Someone's blocking my driveway. And what's worse? Well, you get out of the, normally what you tend to do is you get out of the car, you pull up, you get out of the car, and you see whether they've left a number on the windscreen. Right? That's common courtesy. If you have to park blocking someone's driveway, you leave your number, right? So you can give them a call. But do they do that? No. So now, I'm up here trying to park my car and my driveway is blocked. It gets worse. You know how it gets worse? It's the next door neighbor's car. And they have their own driveway on which they could park. But they don't choose to park there. They park blocking my driveway. See, now when you're in this kind of situation, so many thoughts flood your mind. So many thoughts flood your mind that you almost lose the will to live. Now, if you're a bad person, what are some things that you might tend to do, which I've never done, I have to say. I'm not a bad person. No, I'm serious, I've never done this. But I know some people do that. What are some things that you could do? Yes, you can deflate the tires. Right, you can pull up. You can pull up and you use some of the free parking and you can deflate their tires. Sin or merit? Sin, of course, sin. Then you could do some other things, like you can take a sharp object. I've only said sharp object and you're already nodding. I just said sharp object and you're all nodding. What do you lot get up to? So what do you do with a sharp object? Oh yes. You leave an indelible mark. You leave a mark on their car to say, if you park here, this is what happens. Sin no merit? Sin, of course. There are some less nefarious things to do, not as harmful. Some could be, you go and park on their driveway. Right? That's called retaliation. It's how you say, I'm ready for war. You want to do that? I give you some of your own medicine. Right? That you could do. You can go pull up in front of their driveway and block their entrance. Merit or sin? Merit or sin? Sin, of course, sin. Because what you don't realize is you've taken something that belongs to someone else, and that is why today you're having to pay the price for it. But if you don't stop there, one thing leads to the other, now you have a snowball effect. Right? So, but typically when you're angry, you lose all sense of common sense. You lose all sense of righteousness. You lose all sense of justice. And what the only thing that comes to your mind is, how dare they do this to who? The most important person in the world. Who's that? Me. How dare they do this to me? Some other things you could do is you could pull up, you could walk up their house and... You know, there are two kinds of knocks. There are two kinds of knocks. There's one kind of knock that's more like... It's about three. Three is the count. Right? That's one kind of knock. Then there's... Which one do you use in this instance? The second, of course. So you know. So then they open the door and it gets worse. They open the door and then they have the audacity to ask you, yes, can I help? What do you say to a man who asks you that question after they have just parked blocking your driveway? So by this point, you're already annoyed. By this point, you're already pretty annoyed. So you don't have the typical courtesies that you would normally exchange with them. Like, hey, hi, how you doing? How's it going? You know, good day. Nice weather, isn't it? None of that. Sometimes not even an excuse me. You can give an excuse me if you're feeling a little bit okay, but otherwise, you've just parked outside my door. That is typically what tends to come out. And then from there, it's a complete... It's war. You've just proclaimed war. Sin or merit? Sin. All this while, all of these are sins. And you keep on acquiring more and more sin because you're annoyed. See, you started acquiring sin not when you started doing that, but like I said, you are not hurt for your anger, you are hurt by your anger. So the moment you're angry inside, you've already started burning inside. You've already started harming yourself from within. Now, how does a Dharmishtha Rajagiriyan deal with this kind of a problem? This is how your typical non-tamed mind or the untamed mind deals with this problem. But how does a Dharmishtha Rajagiriyan deal with this problem? Where does Anicchado Kanata come into the picture? Where does we have to be faithful to Swami Nohanse come into the picture? Where does Swami Nohanse is going to ask us now, next Sunday, whether we have been good, and I can't nod my head in agreement if I do all these things, so I have to be the better me. Right? Where does all that come into the picture? So, let's see whether you can use the Dhamma to solve a problem like this. When you're in this situation, to whom has this happened? Who's the victim? Yes. There's a victim, isn't there? In all of this, there's a victim. That is I. I am the victim. Who's the perpetrator? Next door neighbor. So now there's a perpetrator and there's a victim. So there's now you versus your neighbor. But the truth is, you are only a mind. A mind does not even have a car. But when you become an individual, now you have not only a car, you have a house. Your house has a driveway that becomes your driveway. You have a car and you have a right to park your car in your driveway. So you have rights as well now. Minds don't have rights. A mind has no rights. But don't you feel like you have rights? We call them what rights? Human rights. Yes. You have human rights, right? And you will fight for them, won't you? Human rights. That's because you are a... What are you? You are human. Yes. So the moment you identify yourself as a human, now you have human rights. So then... You have bought this house, that's your house, so that's your driveway, this is your car, and so you have a right to access your driveway. These are all those thoughts that come into your mind. See, they flood your mind momentarily, just at an instant. And if at that point you're already not very good with your neighbors, maybe, you know, their kids play in the backyard and they always end up throwing their ball onto your garden, and then all those flowers that you grew, that your flower bed, and those the ball always gets into your garden, and they don't typically tend to come and knock on the door. They jump over the fence, and when they jump over the fence, the kids jump over the fence, they tread on the flowers, and then they get their ball, and then they go back into their place, and that's another problem. And on top of all that, they also have a tree on their side of the, on their garden, and there's an overhang into your side of the garden. And during autumn and all that, you know, all those leaves are in your garden. You're the one who has to sweep everything and so on. And then on top of all of that, you are a heart patient. So the doctor has said that you need to get plenty of rest, right? But next door they have a dog. And what does a dog do? Yes, the dog is always barks. And that dog, so you've complained a few times. You said, hey, you know, can you at least settle the dog at, you know, at these times, because I am a heart patient, right? I need to get rest. So can you please keep your dog quiet until, you know, until the morning at least, and not at night? So you've now asked them about 3-4 times, but nothing seems to be happening. And that's already annoyed you. So their children are annoying. And then every weekend they also have parties. So when they have parties, they invite friends over. And when those friends come, again the whole street is blocked with their cars and all that. And in the morning... The party goes on till the morning, till the wee hours of the morning, and so there's music and dancing and a lot of noise that comes from them. So, you know, all of this is just too much, isn't it? They're just too much. So then on this day, when you find that they have parked your car, their car on your driveway, blocking your driveway, that's just the last straw. You can't take it anymore. You can't take any more than that, surely. So, now, all those things that I just explained to you, the ball, the dog, the music, the friends, right? In all those things, who's the victim again? You. You're the victim. So these things are all happening to you. When did they happen? Not all on one day. They all happened at different points of your life. So ever since, you know, you've been living on this street for the last 3 years, right? They've been here for the last 2 of those years, and over those 2 years, things have just been getting worse and worse and worse. Right? There's no sign of it, of any improvement, and it's getting to a point where either you leave, you pack up and leave, or you have to inform the authorities and get something done. So here's what's been going on in your mind. This is your life. You've been living there for 3 years, 2 of which your neighbors moved in and they have been living there. So at various points of, this is the timeline by the way, at various points of these last 3 years, so we are at 3 years now, actually put it here. On. So this time was peaceful. The house was put up for sale next door and there was no one in there. So, and that was peaceful. You enjoyed all that and things were good. And then they moved in. And then from there on, life has been a living hell because they have just been at it as if, you know, they are neighbors from hell. And their purpose of living there is to make life difficult for you. It comes to a point where it begins to feel that way. So, in this period, now you're going to have to, you know, make your case. Sometimes, you know, when you're at the dinner table, you have friends over and they start the music next door. What will you tell your friends? Oh, they're at it again. You know, these neighbors, like, I'm up to here. Like, I've been telling them, like, from the day they moved in, they've been causing so much grief. I told them, man, that I have this heart problem and I need to get some sleep, and they just won't listen. They don't care one bit. So selfish they are. Says who? Says the selfless saint, that is you. And their children, they're worse than the parents. The dog, you'll hear it barking in a moment. So now you're sharing this with your visitors over dinner. So you're giving an account of what has happened to you over the last year, from year 2 to year 3 of your living in that neighborhood. What you're really saying is, this is me here now. This was when this all started, a year ago. And throughout that time, things have been happening to whom? To me. So what you're implying is, I have been living here for that year and the year before that. I have lived throughout the last 3 years. 1 year of that was peaceful, the first year was peaceful, but then the neighbors moved in, and ever since then, life has been very difficult for me. Now you're telling a story, aren't you? You're relating a story. Meaning you have a story. You're a character now, in a story. Your neighbors are also characters in a story. And you want this visitor of yours to engage in the story. You have just built yourself a story. You are a wonderful storyteller. But come to the Dhamma now for a second. What is there right now? Body and mind. What does your mind look like? What do we normally draw a mind as? Just one of these. Why do we do it like that? Just to imply that it's very momentary, right? No sooner than it arises, it passes away. Does this last 1 year? Does it? 2? No. A few months? A few weeks? Days? Minutes? Seconds? Not even that. So then how come you're talking about something that happened to you over a year? Over the period of a year? Because you have just weaved a story for yourself. You have just created an existence for yourself. An existence that has been going on since the beginning of what you can remember. So since the beginning of your life, but for this conversation, for the last year. And here's what else happens. Now you can't, you're beginning to imagine what life is going to be over the next year. Because you realize that the woman next door, she's, of all things, pregnant. Because what's going to happen if she's pregnant now? Right now they have 2 kids who play ball in their backyard and then keep throwing the ball into yours. Now she's pregnant. How dare she? The least she should have done was ask me, right? Because when 2 becomes 3, what happens? It's going to be even more havoc. And now it's only the dog barking. In 9 months' time, what else are you going to hear? The baby crying. So now you can imagine what the next year is going to be like. This year, so you're now at year 3. Year 4 is going to best be all of these problems and then some. Can you imagine the mindset of a person like that? You know, and they love their home. That's the other problem. They love their home. So they've done it beautifully. The carpets, the furniture, the curtains, right? All hand-picked, made to order, right? The walls painted, all that done to perfection, right? It has taken 1 year to do that. So within the last year of you moving in, you've done it up to your standards, the way you want it, and it's just beautiful, immaculate, just as you wanted it. So now you don't want to leave this place either. This is your home where you feel special. You're the queen or the king. But next door neighbors are making it incredibly difficult for you. So now you're in between a rock and a hard place because you don't want to leave your home because you love it. But you can't be here because your neighbors make it hell for you. Where do things like this happen? En masse, right? Not in your neighborhood. So, I want you to not fail in these kind of situations. Whether this is the driveway, or you're at the queue, at the supermarket. Similar will happen. Someone walks in front of you and now they feel like they should be served before you. These kind of things happen. See, I'm giving you one example. You can then apply the same principles and the same concepts to as many examples as you'd like. That will be part of your homework. Think of one other place where you can apply something like this. I'm talking about your neighborhood. So, this is year 3 where we are. Year 4, you know that there's going to be a new arrival. So, you can be patient. Let's assume that you are. And then later, you get news that she's pregnant with twins. So, not just one. Just when you thought it couldn't get worse. So, you know, what shall we do? Shall we go and talk to the neighbors and ask them to be more considerate Here's how the world solves their problems. Typically, this is how worldly individuals solve problems. Because to them, all of this is annoying, irritating, bothering, troubling. Mentally, it's very taxing. So, typically what people tend to do is they complain. It's a lovely little word, isn't it? Complain. We also love to do that, don't we? Complain. We love to complain. You can either walk up to them and complain, give them a call and complain, or you write a letter of complaint, right? You go to the authorities and complain. You bring the police station and you complain. You go to the ombudsman and you complain. You can complain because complaining is our right, isn't it? And nothing's better than a nice, juicy complaint, right? You got to complain once in a while. Huh? Just, you know, make use of that privilege that we all have as human beings, the right to complain. You must complain from once in a while at least. What's a life that has not complained at least once? To feel that you have lived a full life, you must at least complain once a year. Like put into a list of things to do this year. Make a complaint. Show people that you also have a voice and that your voice has to be heard. And when you draft those complaints, right, make it sharp. When someone reads it, they feel like there are daggers. That letter is full of daggers, not words, but daggers. Oh, I have read a fair few complaints especially when I used to work at the bank. Oh, people know how to write complaints, they do. And words have this magical power. Sometimes knives don't cut that deep. Sometimes knives don't cut that deep. And a cut from a knife sometimes heals quicker than the cut that can be made with carefully chosen, sharp, deliberate words. Very cutting, cutting edge. So that's one thing you could do. You can complain, which is a portal to relieve your vexations, get your stresses heard. Sometimes all you are looking for is an apology from your neighbor, but they just won't give you one. Every time you've been there, you know, hey, pull that car out of the car park, they say, okay, yeah, I'll just be a moment. Sometimes that's what you get. Can you please move your car? It's blocking my driveway. Yeah, sure, I'll just be a moment. And they close the door in your face. And then a few moments later, what happens? The car's still there. So what do you do then? You again walk up. Car. Yeah, just quickly, just be one moment. See? Society tests you, doesn't it? Your neighbors test you. Your family tests you. Your husband tests you. Oh, he always tests us. Your wife tests you. Your children, they were born to test you. Weren't they? They were born to test you. See, this is God's way of checking how ready you are to accept life. But the unfortunate thing is, they never teach us how to prepare ourselves for these situations at school. At college, they don't teach you these things. They teach you how to write a very sharp, critical letter of complaint. I remember learning that. Then you had to have the address, and it always had to be the chief of the companies or executive officers or head of the complaints division or someone like that, customer relations, and then to whom it may concern. That had to be the subject line. And then it had to be sharply worded, and then at the end you can't say, you know, lovingly yours or yours sincerely. No, it should be yours. And I expect this matter to be resolved at the earliest possibility. So that had to be there. You have to have a telephone number in case they have to contact you to get more details. Oh, and also you have to include in the letter, if this situation is not handled to your satisfaction, what course of action you would take. So that they know that if worst comes to worst, what's going to happen to them. All of that had to go into a letter of complaint. See how many things we've learned at school. Shouldn't we be so grateful to all our teachers? And the, you know, our teachers are not to be blamed because they just taught what was in the syllabus. But that syllabus didn't have anicca, dukkha, and anatta. That syllabus never taught you that these things were not happening to a you that you were creating in your mind. They never taught us that you were an illusion. For that, I suppose we just didn't have enough merits, maybe. You can't blame our teachers for that. Can't blame the schooling system, can't blame the books, can't blame the syllabus, because that would be another complaint. We just didn't have the merits. Now you see, if you are here, this is the point you are, having dinner with your friends, with your visitor, you're complaining about the past. This is grieving. It's called grievance. Nice words these are, aren't they? Grievances. Grievances. And fears for the future. You will always find yourself in these situations. They are very common. Very common. So the next time one of these moments strike you, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to be prepared. That's all I want you to be prepared. Prepared not with a sheet of paper and a pen so that you know how to write the perfect letter of complaint. Not prepared with a rifle so that you can teach them a lesson that they will never forget. Not go poison the dog. People have known to do that sort of thing. Right? They say, oh, let me feed the dog for today. Or they give some food to the dog, right? At their home, they go, Tommy, 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 Tommy. And then when Tommy comes, they give Tommy a dog biscuit, but with poison. I'm not making this stuff up, you know that, right? This is just common knowledge. So if you have a dog, be careful if the dog's always barking. Your neighbors might give it a quick trip to heaven. You got to be careful. So that's not what we want. I want you to be someone who has access to unconditional happiness. What do you see here? What's going on here? What sort of happiness are you looking for? Conditional happiness. Because your happiness is conditioned on many factors working out in your favor. In fact, if someone were to, if you know, for Christmas, if someone asks you, what would you like for Christmas? Here's the list that you would give. I want next door neighbors, dog, to be quiet once in a while. I want next door neighbor not to park their car on my driveway. Right? I want next door neighbor to ask me before she becomes pregnant again. See, you would have a long list of things to include on your Christmas wish list. Once again, you're expecting other people to change on your behalf. There's a problem with expecting other people to change, and one big problem with expecting other people to change. That is, yet others like them the way they are. There are others who like them just the way they are. So when you want someone to change the way that you want them to be, but then there's someone else who likes them the way they are, now what are they supposed to do? You see, there's a problem. There's a problem now. It might be that they are happy to change for you, but then someone else wants them to be the way they are for them. So it's a very difficult situation to solve. That's why your happiness should be your own making. Seek your happiness within you without expecting other people to change on your behalf. And besides, You know, one of the best things that you, your Christmas gift could be your neighbors deciding to leave. Right? Perhaps nothing could make you happier. But what if they're replaced by even worse neighbors? Then what? What if these people are replaced by neighbors and they do drugs? Then what do you do? Whenever you expect the world to change to your favor, it's very volatile. Your happiness is very volatile. I want none of you to look for conditioned happiness. Unconditioned happiness comes from within, and that is by understanding the truth behind what's actually going on here. So you see, you can find peace within your own four walls without having to walk up to your neighbor and asking them to change their behavior. You can find peace within your own four walls. Let's see how you can do that. That comes with realization. Realization that you are not who you think you are. That you are just a mind. Let me tell you something. If you understand what I'm about to explain to you, ladies and gentlemen, from here on you will have absolutely no reason to complain. Absolutely no reason to complain about anything that bothers you mentally, not physically. Okay? And here's the story. You know that a mind is only born in response to an external stimulus, right? Right? You will be kicking yourself in the back ass the moment you understand this. So, let's talk it through. You know that a mind is only born in response to a stimulus. And what are these stimuli? You know this now? Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and so on, which has to come in contact with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch and so on. Right? So when these two things come into contact, you have one of these. All with me on that? Do you see that this is the child of these two parents? Yeah? This is the product of these two causes coming together. So every time one of your senses come into contact with the stimulus from the outside world, a chitta or a mind is born. Tell me what happens when the dog barks next door. Exactly. The ear comes into contact with sound and one of these is born. So one of these is born because the dog barked. Yeah? So, should you not be grateful that the dog barked then? Have you ever heard of a child complaining? Because actually there was one instance of this. I remember reading a long time ago. There was a man, I think somewhere in India, who filed a case against his parents for giving birth to him. Because he said, life is really difficult. And I'm having to go through all of this because my parents gave birth to me. So he'd actually filed a lawsuit against his parents. I mean, it took me a while to get my head around what was actually going on there. If this is the child and these are the parents, the fact that this child can complain is only because it was born. So if the dog hadn't barked, this mind would not have been born, let alone complain. Right? So how is it legitimate? How is it possible? How is it okay for a mind to complain for the very reason that it was born and it was brought into existence? What this mind is complaining about is the dog barking. But it is because the dog barked This chitta has come into existence. Because what do chittas do? Their job is to perceive. Aramana vijana lakkana chitta. A chitta's job is to perceive. Perceive a change that happens in the outside world. So when a dog barks, that's a vibration which reaches one of your senses. Now a chitta is born to perceive that. Actually, its whole purpose is to perceive the dog's bark. So what right does it have to complain about the dog barking? You know, if you went up to the dog and say, "Hey, don't bark," the dog would say, "It is thanks to my barking. It is only thanks to my barking that you can even think of complaining about my barking. Because if I hadn't barked, you wouldn't even have been born. So how come you can complain about that?" These are the parents which give birth to these children. So you can't complain about anything, really, because it is those external stimuli that give birth to you. So take this noise, for instance. You can all hear that. That chitta which perceived that noise was born thanks to that noise, meaning me. Now say, "Thank you, Swami Nuhansa." So when someone asks you, "Who gave birth to you?" Don't say, "Swami Nuhansa gave birth to you." But actually, you know, see, that noise, this is what gave birth to you right now. Now, when I say gave birth to you, you need to understand what I mean by this. Not you as humans, I mean the chitta, the mind was only born in response to this sound. The mind is born in response to this sound. The mind is born in response to sight. Unless eye comes into contact with sight or some kind of external stimulus, no chitta would be born, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, if these two things didn't happen, there would be no chittas. Meaning a mind would not come into existence. Meaning there would be no you. So if we feel this continuation, this continuum of our existence, not the jati I'm talking about, just the fact that there's a chitta, if we feel these chittas, thanks to everything that's going on around the world, in your world, meaning you can feel the flow beneath your feet, right? You can feel the air, you can hear this voice, right? You can see things, you can smell things, you can taste things, you can feel the teeth in your mouth with your tongue. All of these things are the reason you continue to exist. A chitta's job is just that, perception. Nothing more than that, ladies and gentlemen. Your purpose is perception. You might say, "No, my purpose is not that, Swami." My purpose is to become a banker. My purpose is to become a lawyer. My purpose is to become a teacher. My purpose this year is to become a mother. No, that's what you think your purpose is. I'm talking about the mind. The mind's purpose is nothing more than perception. Perception is the mind's purpose. And perception can only happen. When these objects meet your faculties, an object, light, some kind of light source, reflects and it reaches your eye. Then you have the optic nerve that is connected to your brain. Your brain then has an interface with your mind base. As a response to this external stimulus, a chitta is born. Please be informed and please know that the purpose of this chitta is nothing more than the perception of this going on. Ditte dittamatta. That's it. The purpose of a chitta is sight. The purpose of a chitta is sound. Because sounds don't exist in the outside world. We've talked about this, right? Sounds don't exist in the outside world. What exists in the outside world? Vibrations. A sound is only created in the mind. Actually, it's not created in the mind. The mind itself is sound. When this chitta is born, this is the moment sound is perceived. Nothing before this is sound. And nothing after this is sound either. Sound only exists in your chitta. So then, what about color? What can you say about color? Does color exist in the outside world? No. Again, this is electrical. This is just electromagnetic radiation, which has no color. All these colors that you think exist, they don't. So what color is my robe? Color? My robe has no color. What color do you see though? You see red or maroon or whatever. You see, that is the color that you see. And each one will see your own version of this color. But it doesn't matter that what you see is different to what someone else sees, because you will all agree on some name for this color, and then we will all agree to call it that color. Sometimes this lady's version of color is different to the next lady's. Sometimes, you know, people at the back, you see a very different color. But color can only exist in this chitta. Sound can only exist in this chitta. What about taste? Nothing like a delicious piece of cake. It's taste, isn't it? Piece of cake, a slice of cake is tasty. Is it? Is there taste in cake? No. Taste does not exist in food. They only have molecules of various shapes. Those shapes trigger receptors on your tongue. And when those receptors are triggered, there's an electrical impulse that travels to your brain, which then interfaces with the mind base, and a chitta is born. That is where taste happens. What about touch? Which part of your body experiences pain? So when you have a backache, which part of your body experiences that pain? The back. Is it the back? When you have a headache, which part of your body experiences that pain? The head. No, ladies and gentlemen. Your physical body, the cells of your body, does not have any capacity to experience these things that we call pain, pleasure, heat, touch, pressure. These are not experienced by the body. They're only stimuli. Those experiences are all in the mind. That's why you are nothing more than your mind. So whenever you talk about experiences, now if you feel a bit cool in this room, it's not any part of your body that feels that. If you switch off the air conditioners, you'll start to feel hot, you'll start to feel warm. That is again not any part of your body that begins to experience that. The floor that you feel underneath your feet, if you press against the floor, what do you feel? Go and press it. What do you feel? Pressure, right? Do you think it's the sole of your foot that experiences that? No. What happens when you press harder and harder is more cells are triggered, more receptors are triggered. Because there are receptors right on the surface of your skin, and there are more receptors a few millimeters beneath. So when you press harder, those receptors are triggered. That's all it is. More receptors are triggered, which sends more electrical signals to the brain, and the brain interfaces with the mind base, and now this feeling of pressure is only a mental feeling. So what are you if not the mind? So then, you see, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, all of these are purely mental experiences. Therefore, it is not your tongue that experiences taste. It's not your eye that sees color. It's not your nose that experiences smell, so on and so forth. So then, when the dog barks, what happens? Next door, dog barks. Sound, ear, brain, mind interface, and Achitta is born. If that dog hadn't barked, then there would be no Chitta. So thanks to the dog and the dog's barking, there's a Chitta. So if I showed you really something really ugly, so let's say the dog's done the dirty, right? And then you see that. Now you don't like it because you don't like the dog. You know, you like the dog, you don't like the dog poo. So when you see the dog's poo, what happens? Sight, right? So object, eye, brain, and Chitta. Thanks to what was a Chitta born? Thanks to the dog doing the poo. So how can you complain then? How can you say that something's ugly if it is thanks to that? Your perception of it has come into existence. Does that make sense, ladies and gentlemen? How can you complain about something if it is purely thanks to that? You have the perception of that object. Isn't that being ungrateful? If you complain about that, isn't that being ungrateful? So, you know, if someone, when someone's shouting at you, or someone's saying something to hurt your feelings or whatever, as they speak to you, chittas are born. Your job is merely to perceive them. We don't have a place to complain. There's no stage to complain. There's no justification for complaint, because those chittas are only born in response to those stimuli. Right, so that's one matter. Then, going back to the problem that we were talking about earlier, we now build on top of this. So we are just the chitta. This is just the mind. That's you, okay? Right. For as long as the parents come together, now what do I mean by the parents coming together? Hold on, there's a phone that I think needs to be switched on, put to silence, because the camera is going to catch the audio and then our people will have to edit it out, and that's going to take a bit of work. So you have the phone that's alerting you. If you could kindly switch it to silent, that would be appreciated. Thank you. So this is you, chitta. When this chitta passes away, another chitta is going to be born. Another is going to be born. And another is going to be born. Before this were yet other chittas, right? But at any moment, there's only how many of them? One of them. At any moment, there's only one of them. Let's take this one. This is the moment where you're at home now and you're having your dinner with your friend. 3 years on from when you moved into your house. At this moment, ladies and gentlemen, you fear for what's about to come to you over the course of the next year. Because, as I said, the wife's pregnant, so not your wife, next door. So she's going to, there's going to be more voices, more sound, more noise going to come from next door. So that's on your mind and that's bothering you. These are all chittas, individual chittas. And these are all chittas at the same time. But when you're here and you begin to experience a sense of existence, existence happens with time. Existence always happens with time. Because to exist is to consume time. To put it very simply, what is to exist? Is to consume time. And to consume time is to exist. So when you talk about existence, now you're talking about existence along a timeline. So if this is now the present, if this is now the present moment, everything on this side is what we call the past. And everything on this side we call the future. So when the now shifts, what else shifts? The past and future shifts. So both the past and the future are anchored on the now. The hardest thing to get our minds around is the fact that when this chitta arises, none of this is there and none of that is there either. Actually, there's no story here. There's no story to tell. There's only this moment. All of these moments are creations of the mind. As the mind tries to tell a story, because the mind looks at things from the past which are in your memory, every experience of the past leaves a record in the main memory, so it's like a log entry per se, right? For it's a very low definition instance of an experience that you've had, a low definition impression of experiences you've had. It's not the full high definition experience, but it's enough to trigger desire within you. For example, now if I say, I'm assume you're a non-vegetarian, right? If I say a tikka masala, a lamb tikka masala, or a nice burger, that might be enough to trigger your sensory system to take a memory from your memory bank, and then perhaps you'll start, your mouth will start watering. If I said a nice, say if I say, even when I say the word a lime, a citrus fruit, right? Your body will begin to respond to that. A sour lime, and then your mouth will begin to respond to, as if it was happening right now. That's because although you don't have the actual fruit in your hand right now, there are low definition impressions in your memory. And those low definition impressions are sometimes enough to come to the present and trigger a physical response in the body. It's very sophisticated how all of this works, but it's all explainable through the Dhamma. See, now forgive me for using this example, but this is all to help you understand, okay? We don't have any children in the room today, do we? No, it's a safe environment. Is it not possible to remind you of some sensual thought and trigger lustful feelings without actually giving you the actual experience? Don't nod. Just listen. I don't know how safe this is on a sermon, but I will say, and I just want you to understand what I'm talking about, right? They call it eroticism. So I'm not going to say it, don't worry. You could describe a situation and then trigger an erotic response in the mind. This is not possible in an arahant or in someone who has good understanding of the Dhamma, because it is merely an illusion of the mind. But to the untamed mind, it's possible to describe. Let's say someone did that. I asked someone to describe. Parts of a body, say the female body, in a way that triggers lustful thoughts in the mind. Now, I'm not showing you anything. I'm not showing it to you. But words will do the trick. What will words do? I could describe, say, the shape of something. Okay? I can say, it looks like this, looks like that. Now, sometimes when you do literature, there are certain works of literature which are very, sorry, but the word is erotic. As you read that, your mind is able to create mental imagery. But maybe a 2-year-old or a 5-year-old might not understand it, because they cannot create those images in their mind. But if you have those mental images in your memory bank, which are low definition images, when you describe it, those images can be formed in the mind, and then sometimes it's enough to trigger a physical response to that. Don't nod. Just listen. Sometimes it's enough to create a physical response. See, you need to understand how you work, because it's all in the mind. But if you're also going through other thoughts like fear, anger, at those times, it doesn't have the same effect. That's again because it's all in the mind. I don't know whether it was to this audience or to a different audience I asked this question. When I say the word, I don't know how far I can go with this. Will you promise me to only use this for your practice? Will you? If I describe a woman's breast, and in the same breath I say the word mother, see, different thoughts, different response. Assume I described a woman's breast, its shape and all that, right? Color, texture, whatever and all that. And then I say a mother's breast. I was talking about a mother's breast. See, completely different experience, right? So, that lustful feelings were not in the words. They were all created in the mind. So, and then where did that lust go the moment I said mother? Your mind stopped creating it. It didn't go anywhere, it didn't come from anywhere, the mind stopped creating it. Because the word mother triggers a completely different mental response to what might have initially come into your mind when I hadn't mentioned the word mother. A breast is to nurse, to feed the child. But as human beings mature, they stop seeing that organ as an organ to feed the child. They begin to sexualize it. But that sexuality is not in that organ. If it were, how would a child be able to feed on the mother? So do you see that sexualization is not in any part of the body, it's not in any organ. It's purely mental. The mind creates that. And that is why, if I were to describe that organ without mentioning the word mother, these chittas can keep on creating various impressions of it and various emotions to it, and then I drop the word mother just like that, and those lustful thoughts disappear just like that, because the next chitta stops creating that feeling of lust, that emotion of lust. So, you know, these are all very momentary mental experiences. I'm quite liberally saying these things to you because I feel you're a mature audience who has the capacity to take this in the spirit that I mean it. I might not even get arms today. today no arms anyway. So today is the kind of day I have to talk about this kind of thing. there's little risk. But you know, this is your manual. This is the manual of the mind. The Dhamma is the manual of the mind. How does the mind work, and why does the mind respond in certain ways? So you know, now if you are someone, or if you know someone who seeks pleasure in various parts of a body, I would like for you to understand that those triggers are not in any part of the body. Both men and women have a reproductive system. They don't have what is called a sexual system. Do you remember learning that at school? There was a respiratory system, the digestion system, the circulatory system. We learned about the reproductive system. There's nothing called a sexual system, was there? No, because there is no such thing called a sexual system. That's all created in the mind, the untamed mind. Not just about any mind, the untamed mind. That's why such thoughts never occur in the tamed mind. Lust is an extension of desire, which in itself is an extension of delusion. So the Buddha and his arahants will never experience these emotions called lust, because their minds have been tamed. Their minds are free. Now, think about a time when you might have experienced those kind of thoughts. Do you feel cool, calm, peaceful? Or do you feel like you're on fire? Isn't that what it feels like? Don't nod. It feels like you're on fire. Your heartbeat increases. Sometimes you start to sweat. Right? Your whole system heats up. Meaning you're not at peace. You're not cool. Your mind does that to the rest of your body. Your whole system begins to heat up. That's when desire, lust takes over. It's not natural. It's not natural because that thought, that emotion is not in the rupa. It's not in an object. It's not in the Vedana. It's not in sanya. It's not in sankara. It's not in vijnana. It is a creation of the mind because of jati. But most people will not understand what I'm explaining to you, because for most people this is natural, they feel. It's how human beings are, it's how animals are, it's how we all are. And people feel that it's very perfectly acceptable and normal to have such thoughts, whereas, ladies and gentlemen, it's not. I'm not suggesting that from here on you should not have such thoughts, because for that the mind has to be tamed. And without such thoughts, the world wouldn't continue. Right? The world, someone has to make the world continue. I'm not going to be doing that, so be my guest. But the thing is this, the world can only continue thanks to untamed, ailed minds. I'd rather you were not in that pool. I'd rather you were free from such ailments of the mind. This is all you are. Lust does not come from sight. Anger does not come from sight. It has to be created in the mind. So, conversation diverted. Let's come back to your neighbor. Here we are, now, at this moment, because of ignorance and attachment, what we call jati takes place. Jati is a creation of the mind. Jati is your sense of existence. When jati happens, you have answers to questions like this. Okay? To whom did yesterday's events occur? You have an answer to that. The answer is what? Me. To whom will tomorrow's events occur? You have an answer to that. And the answer is again, me. So do you see that there is an individual to whom all these experiences happen? All of these events, they happen to an individual, an entity. That is you. But where is the room for a you here? Where is the space for a you? Where is the foundation for a you? If all there is a chitta and there are no two chittas at the same time, where is this you that you're talking about? It has to be an illusion of the mind. Has to be. This mind, ladies and gentlemen, has to create this sense of you. Now, do you remember the other day I said, this is so ironical. Because if you take a cup and make tea in that cup, right? If you add the same ingredients, precisely the same quantities, you will not be able to tell the difference between the two once you take a sip of it. It has to be precisely the same ingredients, brewed to the same duration of time, stirred the same number of times, etc., same temperature, right? All of that. If all of them were identical, then you would not be able to tell two cups of tea apart. Even if someone else made it, you would still not be able to tell them apart, because they would be, for all intents and purposes, identical. In the same way, if you take two chittas, and in each of them you had ignorance and attachment. Okay, let's just say ignorance, just for the sake of brevity. Ignorance in each of them. In each of them you would see the creation of a sense of self. Why do I call it a sense of self and not self? Am I just giving myself punishment by using more words? No, it is not a self actually. It's only a sense of self. Meaning there is no self there to perceive. The mind senses it and then the mind creates it. And that's why it's called the sense of self. So if ignorance is what creates a sense of self in here, and we call that jati, and ignorance does it here, and we also call that jati, if we were to switch these two jatis, if we were to swap them, would these two minds be able to tell the difference? Would they? No. They would not be able to tell the difference. It's like if I had two pens of the same color and I took off the caps and swapped them, and then I ask you, right, which cap belonged to what? Without, you know, I would hide it from you and do it, and then I ask you, you would not be able to tell the difference because they look identical. See, this is the funniest thing I find in all of this, ladies and gentlemen. If we were to swap your jati with someone else's jati, you would not be able to tell that something of that sort had happened. So in the same way that you experience that you are an identity, you know, that exact feeling is what the person next to you has about themselves. So how are we so different to each other? the very feeling that you have that you are different is the same feeling that the person next to you has. So how are you really so different then? It's identical. It has to be identical because it's the same causes that create the same effect. So really, your feeling of an identity is not unique at all. It's the most common experience there ever is and there ever was. Your dog feels the same sense of identity as you do, meaning the sense of self. So when you say I with some feeling, that you say the word I with feeling, right? I. Not I whatever, but I. Whenever you say I, do you not have a feeling around that? The feeling of you? Although your dog can't say the word I, it feels the same feeling, I. We could swap it with yours and you would not be able to tell the difference. You would not begin to feel like a dog all of a sudden. And the dog wouldn't begin to feel a human. Because all we've done is swap the eyes, the sense of I, and no difference would be experienced. You must understand why I'm trying to explain this fact to you. That is because although we feel that we are so unique, we are not at all unique. Not one bit of us is unique. So then all these differences that we try to entertain, either by creed, race, religion, gender, all of these things are utterly useless. That's why for someone who comes and asks, Swami Nohansa, I'm a lesbian. Is that okay? Or can you help me? My answer is, Madam, you're not. You think you like women, therefore, and you are a woman, and therefore you think you're lesbian. Madam, you are not a woman in the first place. You are just a mind. But in the modern age, people fight for rights. LGBTQ, thank you, plus. People fight, they lobby for rights. We are fighting the wrong war. That's what I'm trying to say. But no one's going to listen to me. These are the universal truths, but no one's going to hear me speak. They don't have to listen to me, but this message is what should be heard in the United Nations councils. This message is what should be heard for world peace. This message should be what is heard for people to find peace within them. This is the message that transcends all these boundaries, all these differences that we all feel and perceive. This is the message of uniformity. That deep down, we are none of those things. And these are only perceptions of a deluded mind. None of you are women, I'm sorry to say, and none of you are men. None of you are old and none of you are young. None of you are rich or poor. None of you are black or white. None of you are Asian or Caucasian. You are just minds. A mind that is born simply because an object came into contact with the eye. That's all you are. Thank you. That's all you are. Your realization of that is the day you find peace within you. See, until then, you will fight for your own people. You will fight for rights of your own people. You will like to associate with whom? Your own people. And when you do that, you discriminate yourself. No one here needs to discriminate you. You discriminate yourself. People say that discrimination, that the others discriminate me. They discriminate my race. They discriminate my people. They discriminate my nation. You discriminate yourself by saying that you are so and so. So there's gender discrimination, there's race discrimination, right? There's all that around the world, right? Discrimination begins with an ignorant mind. And wherever there is ignorance, there is discrimination. What is to discriminate after all? To separate, isn't it? That is what to discriminate means. To discriminate is to separate. So wherever there is ignorance, there's discrimination. The moment you say that you are someone, have you not just discriminated the entire universe? Have you not? The moment you say that I am me, I'm an individual, have you just not discriminated the entire universe? I'm separate to the whole universe, they're not me and I'm not them. You're asking for it. This is the message for world peace. This is what both the victim and the culprit should listen to, should hear. Both the rapist and the raped must hear these words, not my words, these words, the words of uniformity. Both the abused and the abuser should hear these words. But people will not. Because if they did, the whole world would cease to operate. But the wars should keep on going. There should be people who fight for peace. Right? There should be people who fight for hunger. People who fight for various causes. And that's how the world works. You know, to me, it's just like child play now, really. What all these people are fighting for. Boundaries, nations, territorial wars, gender wars, racial wars. All of these, to me, is just child play. It's really very childish. How immature. The only reason is they have not grasped any of these truths. They don't know who they are. You can be messengers of the truth. You can take this message to others. Take it if you care about your fellow men and women. Take this message to others. Don't take me. I won't come. Take this message to others. This is not about a religion. It's about explaining to you that you are just a mind. Where's the religion part in this? Is this only for Buddhists? So Buddhists are just a mind, Christians are something else. Is it? No, there's nothing Buddhism, there's nothing about being Buddhist here. It's just what you are, your mind and body, and minds are merely formations at that moment. But in there, if there's ignorance, you have a sense of separation. That separation is your discrimination. And when you have that sense of separation, now you will fight for yourself. You will fight for self-preservation. You and your people are more important than they and their people. How can there be they and their people if there is no you and your people? This is why there's so much hate in this world. Because there's me and my people. So of course there's going to be hate. Because there's me and my people. When there's no you, how can there be you and your people? This is just you, chitta. A chitta is formed because an object comes into contact with the eye. A chitta is formed because a sound comes into contact with ear. A taste comes into contact with tongue. That's how a chitta is born. Not how you are born. That's how a chitta is born. So how are you born then? When there's ignorance in the mind, the ignorant mind vexes us for a sense of identity. And out of that vexation comes the creation of an identity. But lo and behold, the same process takes place in every single chitta, not just within you, but in every body. Therefore, that sense of identity that you experience is not unique at all. The last thing it is unique. But what do you fight for? What do you want? Uniqueness. How deceived can you be? See, the only reason that you can carry on doing this is because you cannot sense what the other person's sense of identity feels like. If you could, that would be the day that you give up this whole thing. Your sense of identity, you can't cross-check that with someone else's sense of identity, can you? Because they all say I, you also say I, and but you don't think that the same I is experienced in the other person, right? You think they're a different I and you're a different I. Because of that, you continue this game of creating these I's, but if just for one moment you are able to actually sense someone else's sense of I, you'd be shocked. That's what you'd be. You'd be utterly shocked. You'd hold your head in your hands and go, "Good Lord, that's the same I that I'm experiencing. And I thought we were different. But we are the same. So what's the point of me thinking that I'm a separate individual? When my sense of uniqueness, or I thought was, is the same sense that you have, then we are the same in every regard." Please try and realize this, ladies and gentlemen. You are not different to the person next to you. Then all these separations, all this discrimination, all this isolation, all this segregation is because your sense of identity tells you that you are a unique individual. And that's why you fight all these useless battles for your rights, your place in the world, recognizing you as an individual. These are things that you want. You want as in the mind wants. So I'm not saying you want, okay? This is not an accusation. This is an explanation of what's going on in your minds. When you want people to recognize you and acknowledge you, that is because you feel that you are unique. If there's a test, who would you like to come out first? If there's a competition, a race, okay, who would you like to come out first? Who? Who? Yes, that is who came first. Let me explain what I mean by that. I'm laughing already, you will laugh in a moment, okay? There's a race, okay? Three people are running. Let's assume that this is you. This is you. This is Sam. And this is Stacy. You, Sam, and Stacy. Why these names? Well, people listen to these sermons from across the world, so Sam and Stacy. I can go with Siripal and Somalata. But for that, come to the monastery, okay? Siripal and Somalata also works. You, Sam and Stacy, right? Now, this is a race, and the winner gets the prize. In this situation, who do you want to come out first? Who? Come on, let's all, right? There's no doubt, no contest there, right? We all want you as in me, ne? Me. That's me. We want me or I to come first. Right? See, here's the thing. Who is this I that you're talking about?
Me or I?
Who's this I you're talking about? In the chitta, not the chitta. Chitta is not I. Chitta is not I, right? Chitta is not I. Chitta is merely the product of senses coming into contact with stimulus. Okay? So that's not I. In this chitta, due to ignorance, a sense of I or a sense of self is created. Agreed? Yes, we've talked about this. This sense of self we call me. Okay? What's going on here? The same, right? What's going on here? The same. So who do you want this to win this race? Who do you want to win this race? Me, right? Yeah. So then why does it matter who crosses the finish line first? This is the beauty of the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen. You can rejoice in all goodness. It matters not to whom it happens. Experience the freedom that I have in my heart, which comes through understanding the Dhamma. Take what I give to you so freely. This freedom, this joy, untainted bliss, the ability to rejoice in goodness that happens to everyone, and no desire that such goodness must happen to me. But that can only come when you realize that in each of these is also a me. The same me that's happening here. So if the same me that is happening here as is happening here, why does it matter who comes first? Because whoever comes first, that's me. Because what is me after all? It's a sense of self. And that sense of self is a product of ignorance. Okay, we don't like ignorance, but put that to aside for a moment. Our dislike for ignorance. My point is this. This sense of self is a product of the same causes. So for this one individual, say this is Stacy, for Stacy's sense of self to occur requires the same causes for Sam's sense of self to be created, which is the same causes for your sense of self. So if it's the same causes, it's the same product, same effect. So then it doesn't matter which me crosses the line first, does it? So now who has to win this race? The real answer is, it really doesn't matter. Now, no matter who wins, we have all won. It doesn't matter now who wins, we have all won. Next time they have the Olympics, see whether you can watch a game of Olympics and enjoy every gold medal. See if you can do that. So you clap for the gold, you clap for the silver, you clap for the bronze, you clap for the complimentary prizes if there are any. You clap for everyone. Then it doesn't matter whether Sri Lanka got the cup or not. It shouldn't matter if you have realized the truth. It is only a fool who cannot enjoy in the rewards that others receive and the others get. Only a fool cannot enjoy and rejoice in that, which is such a pity, such a pity. You need not be like that. They say good sportsmanship is where you should be able to appreciate anyone's victory. Yes, but when they say that, they still feel inside of them, could have been me. But hey, good sportsmanship, so let's applaud for everyone's victory. Right? That is good sportsmanship. Yes, I get that. But, you know, even if there was good sportsmanship amongst everyone, if you ask the individual that lost, would you not rather have had your team win? They would say, yes, of course. But someone won and that's okay. I'm talking about something beyond that. That is a very worldly, two-dimensional explanation. That's trying to be okay with someone else winning. But here, what I'm trying to get across to you is, there is no one individual winning. Every victory is my victory. See, that's how you can have altruistic joy. Joy in every success. So in yesterday's sermon, we asked the question, when your child becomes first in class, right, you are happy. But what about when someone else's child becomes first in class, making your child the second? He comes to you with his record book and says, Mommy, this time I'm second. Every other time he was first in class and you were over the moon about it. This time he's second in class. Can you have the same joy as you did before because someone's child has still come first? That's difficult, isn't it? Because you know, I mean, the fact that he's come second means, or she's come second means someone's child has come first, right? The only difference now is, it's not your child. But someone's child has come first, but you can't rejoice in that. It's virtually impossible to rejoice in that. That someone's child has come first because it has to be whose child? My child, then yes, I'm happy. See, me and mine. Isn't there where discrimination occurs? Why can't we celebrate in someone else's child coming first? Because after all, it's not someone else's child. Whose child is it? It's again my child. Is it not? See, this is you. This is you and your child. Okay? This is someone else and their child. What are you? A citta. But what is this you you're talking about? That's a sense of self. So if this is a sense of self that's occurring, that's going on in your mind, is it not the same thing that's going on in this person's mind? Is it not? Then if your child also has a sense of self, what about this child? Is it not the same sense of self? So then if this child comes first, why can you not rejoice in it? Just as if your child had come first, because it's the same sense of self in everyone. So who should win the lottery? Who should win the Sanidha Jayamal? Who should win it? See if you can bring yourself up to a point where you can say, anyone. And that's okay. Anyone. Who should be served first in a queue? Anyone. Who should get the first piece of something that is good? Anyone. Who should drive a nice car? Who should have the nicest house? And who should get that next promotion? Oh. What about the bonus at the end of the year? Right? They split it up and each one gets a portion of the bonus. Who should get the largest chunk? If your mind is ignorant, you will tell it is I who should get it. But if you can see through the lens of Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, it wouldn't matter who gets it. There's so much goodness going on in this world that, but because we discriminate ourselves from the world, we do that, don't forget, we do that, no one else is responsible for that. No one else is responsible for that. You do your own discrimination, thank you very much, no one else needs to help. Because you discriminate yourself, there's so much goodness happening in this world and you can't rejoice in it because you don't have altruistic joy. Embrace all goodness. Imagine you're in the queue for something and there is only a few items left, right? Stock clearance. You're in the queue, only a few items left, and two people before you got the last one, or the one before last, and the person before you now gets the last one, meaning you don't get one. You can go home remorseful, sad, disappointed that you couldn't get what you wanted, or you can go home happy that someone got it. See, if you can always be like that, you are someone with a full mind. A full mind. Not an empty mind. A full, wholesome mind. That's the state I want you all to aspire to. That mind is always very beautiful. It's always very joyful. That is a contented mind. There's not a void in there. It's always full. No void. A void always has to be filled with something. So then, I mean, if you can understand some of this philosophy, if someone else, let's say you're dating. Say you're dating. Right? But someone else takes her. Someone else takes him. You should be able to say, well, someone got her. Can I ask you a question? See whether you can answer this frankly. Okay? If your wife is not happy with you, if your wife is not happy with you, and she chooses to be with someone else, are you someone who can truly be happy about that? Yes, please, Swaminas. Because I didn't say one other thing that was the crucial part. You still want to be with your wife. Because if you don't want to be with her, then of course you'd be happy for her to be with someone else. But you want to be with your wife, you still love her, right? You really love her, you truly love her, but she has lost interest in you. And she has found, there's newfound interest in someone else. You know, she's scared to tell you about this. You know that, right? She's scared to tell you about this. He's scared to tell you about it. Why? For the reasons that we talked about right at the beginning of this sermon. You can protect her from someone else, but how can you protect her from you, from yourself? Because you have a short fuse. Because your joy is not her joy. Your joy is your joy. Therefore, she cannot come up to you and say, honey, I have some news for you. You are no longer honey for me. I have another honey. Will you let me go? Because my love is now somewhere else. I no longer have this feeling that I had towards you anymore. If you can truly, at that moment, be happy for her, then you are a remarkable individual. But I know that what I say is almost on the verge of fantasy. 9.9999999 people are not going to be happy with that, because they cannot take joy in someone else's happiness. For them, joy has to be their own happiness. But if you understand this philosophy, you can elevate yourself to that level. Where you have no jealousy. Where the best things in life doesn't always have to come to you. It doesn't matter who it gets to. You're happy about it. For that, you have to have a mentality that sees uniformity. We are all together. This is all just the same thing. Not me, he, she, it, they. All these pronouns that we have come to learn, which we use to label the separate things. That's the thing. You know, if this is not world peace, I don't know what is. These are the weapons you need for world peace. The Dhamma is the weapon. It's because people cannot understand these truths. They identify themselves as individuals, as a nation, as a race, as a creed, as a religion. Right now, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, what did we have in Sri Lanka? Not 30 years ago, sorry. We had a 30-year-old long war in Sri Lanka, didn't we? About how many years ago did we see the end of it? 16 years ago. About 16 years ago, we saw the end of that. But for 30 long years, right, we killed each other. Doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter who won. We all lost. Actually, there was no victory. There was no victory. We all lost. Because every life that was lost was a life that was consciousness, wasn't it? And I'm not just saying this because somehow conventionally we won. So we have the upper hand. So that's not why I'm saying this. The truth is the truth. Regardless, we all lost. We lost human potential. We lost talent. We lost goodness. We lost humanity. A lot was lost. But then, you know, if you could see that these are all individual, these are all consciousness, and in each of them is a sense of self. If this message was available back then, perhaps it was. No one heeded. Maybe, I don't know. I was not there when it happened. But if this message was there, why would there be terrorism? See, think about this for a second. Why would you want to terrorize yourself? A terrorist is someone who terrorizes, right? Who inserts terror into someone else's mind. But if you can appreciate that these are all the same, this is also me, this is also me, this is also me, this is also me, we are all me's. This is a room full of me's. Why would I terrorize myself? In harming you, I harm myself. In taking something that belongs to you, I take something that belongs to myself. Stealing from you is stealing from myself. Killing you is killing myself. Hurting you is hurting myself. If people could appreciate that, there would be no wars. In vain, lives are lost. Even today, there are wars going on, right? Last time I checked, still people fighting. And technology is used for all the wrong reasons. See, is this not what technology should be used? So that this message could be shared far and wide. That is what you use technology for. That is why you use technology to share the sermons. You use these cameras are here recording this message. These microphones are here recording this thing. This is what we should be using technology for. Technology should be man's friend, not man's enemy. He was invented by man. Why do we invent things to destroy ourselves? I mean, not even animals don't do that. We seem to have so much intelligence about us that we create things that destroy ourselves. Remarkable. I want you all to be agents of peace. See if you can do that. I can only do a very small part in this world. A very small part. I'm just a drop of water, but together we are an ocean. You can all be agents of peace. Create the platform where messages like this can cross through people's ears into people's minds and heal. Heal hearts. Where people can understand that when you kill your brother, when you kill another, you're only killing yourself. When you hurt another, you're only hurting yourself. When you murder another, you're only murdering yourself. Actually, murder is the same as suicide. What's the difference? After all, you've just taken the life of someone that thinks that they're a self, just like you do. So, back to your neighborhood. What's going on there now? 9 months have passed since the start of this conversation. And now there's a newcomer to the family. So you live in, where's that timeline gone? Here's a timeline. We're at 3 years, 2 years, 4 years. You lived in fear of what was to come over the course of the next year. You had grievances about what was happening over the last year, and you were complaining about them now, right? Once you understand that you are only a mind, and a sense of self is only created because of your own vexation, because of your own need to appreciate or to experience a sense of identity. It is because of that, it is out of that springs this sense of self. That spawns the sense of self. What happens then, ladies and gentlemen, is this moment at which you are talking about this experience of the past and the future, you project a future and you project a past. And that past and future seem like it both happens and will happen and happened to you. It seems like that. But that is not the truth. Nothing has ever happened to you because this is the first time you have come into existence as chitta. And when this chitta passes away, it will be a brand new chitta that comes up next. And that chitta has never seen the day of light. Day of light? Light of day. And the chitta that was there before, that's past. That chitta is not this chitta. And that is what you are. Can you bring yourself to live in this moment, in the chitta? That is the whole aim of this game. The ultimate goal is that, to bring yourself to a point where you only exist in a moment of the chitta. That's it. That does not mean that you cannot plan for the future. That does not mean that you can't analyze the past. The only difference is, you will be dealing with data and facts without the sense of or the burden of a self. Now you see, when someone comes up to you and says they have a problem, you can give them advice, can't you? You can guide them, you can give them advice without personifying that or without making that personal. You don't personalize the problem. You give them advice, and it's easier to give them advice because it's not your problem, right? When someone's got a problem, they come to you for counsel. You give them advice very freely and very coolly, relaxed. And you know, sometimes they're crying their eyes out, but you say, hey, don't worry, you know, things will be fine. Don't worry, don't stress about it. You know, problems happen to everyone. It's all right, just relax, don't worry, I'm here for you. See, all those things that you tell them. But when you have the problem, Where's all that advice gone? Now you get off the pedestal, right? And now you become a very ordinary person. You're now just as bad as they were when they had the problem. This is because when they come to you with the problem, you don't make that your problem. See, what if you could look at all your problems without the you? Imagine that situation. If you could look at all problems but without the you in it, then there would just be problems to be solved. Just like how when you help people solve their own problems. But the moment you put your you in there, now it becomes your personal problem. Then it's very hurtful. Then there are grievances. Then there's fear. Then there's sorrow. And when all these emotions begin to burden you, now you feel the sheer weight of all that. It crushes you. And with that weight on your shoulders, you just don't have the peace of mind to look at problems subjectively, rather objectively. It becomes a very subjective engagement. That is where we fail. That is where we fail. Here's what the Arahant is capable of doing. Look at all problems objectively. They can plan the future objectively. They can analyze the past objectively. Therefore, the past events does not bring them grief, does not bring them sorrow, because those are events of the past which are very objective. There's no subject in it, no doer, just the done. They can plan for the future. They can plan what they're going to do next. They can look at a problem and look at, right, let's do this and try that. Maybe that'll work. Let's see. They can do all that. So planning is not forbidden for Buddhists. Planning is not forbidden for those who see, for those with insight. It's not forbidden. We plan all day long. We have to run a whole monastery with 800 people who are daily residents of that place. We plan. Like planning is going out of fashion. That's not a problem. But we look at every moment objectively. So assume that we plan something and the whole thing fails. We are able to say, ah, is that so? And move on. And then we analyze what had happened. We look at what the missing part was. We look at where we missed the trick. We look at what piece of information should we have had before we should have made that decision. And then we go and learn that. We study. We analyze. We seek guidance. We get advice. We go out, read books. We find information. And then we try it again, if it's worth trying. But in no part of this was I the doer. I have no part to play in this world. That is the ultimate understanding. I have no part to play in this world. It's such a simple thing to say, but there's so much profoundness in that line. I have no part to play in this world. Your acceptance of that is your nirvana. You have no part to play in this world. Let the world happen. Let it happen. Contribute. Of course, contribute. To contribute is to understand that there are causes that manifest as effects. Therefore, you need to study what those causes are and contribute those causes. But understand that it is not I who is doing that. This is the I. It's not an I who is doing it. It's vipaka. That's not to say that you can just turn a blind eye and let anything happen. It's not that. It's not about let anything happen. That's just complacency. That's just negligence. That's not what we want. Negligence is not part of the sasana. On one occasion, there was a monk who was in deep meditation. The Buddha arrives. He realizes the monk is in meditation, but he also realizes that he hadn't swept his kuti. And there was dust everywhere. What he did was he left his footprint and went away. So when this monk came back from his, or arose from his meditation, he realized the Buddha had been here, and he realized that he'd left a lesson for me. I can't be negligent. I should sweep this kuti and keep it tidy. So that's what he did next. So just because we are striving for Nibbana doesn't mean we can just let anything happen and let it be. Let the world go to the dogs. You can't do that. It's not that. Contribute. But without an investment of yourself. Contribute energy. Contribute knowledge. Contribute experience. Contribute wisdom. Contribute actively. Without the self. It's possible, ladies and gentlemen, although you might feel, how is that possible? I don't get it. It's possible. It's possible because we are doing it. And we know it's possible. Your sense of self brings you nothing. It brings nothing to the party other than suffering. That's all it brings. It brings baggage. Baggage that you don't need. This is the only thing that happens when you bring yourself to the party. When things don't go to plan, you suffer. When you have a plan, you are worried whether you might be able to live up to your plan and get it all done the way you want to. That's the only thing you play in this picture. Nothing else. So what's the point of that self if all it is just a party pooper? Don't bring the fellow. It just spoils the whole thing. You don't need a self to plan things. You don't need a self to analyze things. You can do a post-mortem. It's fine. Just leave the self out. You can't just kick the fellow out though. You create the self, so you have your understanding, your realization of the Dhamma is what's going to eradicate that sense of self. And that's the whole thing. So where does all this lead you to? Where do we bring all this together? Where this all comes together is to understand firstly that this sense of individualness that you experience is a lie. It's not individual at all. It's not a self, it's only the sense of self. It's only a perception of self, but that self does not really exist. By which you need to understand that you are not a unique individual as you might think you are. Therefore, appreciate and embrace everyone and everything. Everyone is part of your own family. Everyone is you. It's not you and them. It's not you and her or you and him. Once you understand this, sorry to ask this question, but how can you get married? How could you? How could you get married to yourself? See, the only reason that the construct of marriage can survive is when ignorance takes over and you think you are separate to someone else. So now you feel that the two of us can live together. Marriage is for crazy people. Sorry. It's okay for me to say that because I was also married once. Right? So I take that liberty. But marriage is for crazy people. Because when you feel that you are a self, you feel lonely. We talked about loneliness last week. In the word loneliness is hidden oneness. It's hidden in there, one. L-O-N-E, right? See, there's one hidden in loneliness. So when you are one, when you think that you are one and one is separate from everyone else, now you feel lonely. So when you are lonely, you need the association of someone else so that you don't feel lonely anymore. You need companionship. And when you need companionship, you can't just go have everyone and anyone because others also want them. So we have to come up with some kind of convention whereby we are allowed one individual to spend the rest of our lives with. You know, can I ask you a question? Forgive me for asking many of these questions today. I don't know where they're coming from, but I will ask nonetheless. Right? So, here's the thing, right? You're married, right? I'm talking to the couples. That's because you love them and they love you, right? Do you think that if the law allowed if the law allowed for your partner to have another spouse, meaning if the law allowed for your husband to have another wife, what do you think he would do? If the law allowed it and it was acceptable. See, your husband loves you, right? Of course he does. Right? He loves you and only you, right? And then the same goes for the wives, right? For the wives, you love your husbands and you love only them, just them, no one else. Okay. But if the law allowed for it, it was okay to keep two wives or to keep two husbands, what do you think your other half would do? Don't answer that, especially if they're here with you. Here's what I want to get across to you. They're not bad. They're not evil. They don't want to fool you. They don't want to deceive you. But they have needs. They have wants. What they want is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Not you. Sorry. It is not you they want. They want sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, a sense of safety, right? A sense of sometimes maybe supremacy, and perhaps they get that from you because they feel superior in your presence. Maybe in your relationship, if they didn't get that, your relationship won't last very long. That is also possible. It's sometimes very cultural that sometimes the husband wants to feel superior. And if the wife is not playing ball, then that relationship won't last very long. In some relationships, it can be the other way around. The wife wants to feel superior, and if she doesn't get it, then that relationship won't last very long. Sometimes the wife wants freedom. She wants to be able to do her own thing, right? Do the house the way she wants, do the whatever job that she wants to do, but the husband doesn't like it. That relationship won't last very long. See, although we keep trying to tell ourselves that they are mine and for me, it's not like that really. They are theirs and for them. I don't make the rules, I'm sorry to hurt you, or I don't mean intend to hurt you, and I really hope that I'm not offending you or insulting you or making you feel that this is nothing like that. This is just opening your eyes up to reality. I really like it when the both of you come and listen to the Dhamma. It's a great achievement when you can do that. Because here's what happens then. The two of you become noble friends to each other. Now that is a keeper. If the two of you can become noble friends to each other, that is true love. Because from there on, it's not about what's for me, it's about what's right for them. Insecurities, they start to disappear. Because you realize, what insecurity? What insecurity? There's only a mind. It's a sense of self that experiences insecurity. It's a sense of self that feels I need to be superior. And all of that starts going out the window. We talked about lust a moment ago. When there is no self, right? When you realize that you're just a chitta and you stop being a man or woman, what's there to get from the other person? What physical contact do you need? After all, you've never experienced what the other person feels like. You think that you touch the other person, that's not their touch that you experience. Your receptors are your receptors. No matter what you touch, you can only experience what your receptors bring you. You can't experience another person's touch or the touch of another person. They're holding your hand is not them holding your hand that you feel. It's just your sensory receptors being triggered. So then, what touch do you want? What touch can you get even if you wanted it? What smell, what taste, what sight, all of those are creations of the mind. So you can't get any of these things from another person. All that's left to do is to feed them, shelter them, look after them, all for nothing. Just a lot of work. I mean for both parties, just a lot of work. That companionship is because you feel lonely. But if you can come out of that and not feel lonely, and you're just a chitta, you don't need companionship. See, you feel you need companionship because your mind is not strong enough. It's like a vine that needs something to twist around, twirl around. Like a climber that needs something to grasp. Something to wind itself around. That's what a mind that feels loneliness has to go through. You can come out of that. All you need to do is understand the Dhamma. So when you're feeling angry, which is where we started this conversation and which is where we'll end this conversation, when you're feeling angry, if you imagine the future where you're going to get a lot of grievance from your neighbor, you forget the fact that each chitta is only born because of a sensory stimulus. So actually you should be grateful for every bark, every cry, every thing that's going on in the world, because that is what gives rise to those chittas in the first place. But when you feel that this, when you feel a sense of yours, of identity, that you are an individual, and that individual feels that it has to be respected, its rights have to be observed and obeyed by others, and that others should not encroach on your porch or your personal space or your driveway, and they should leave you the flexibility and freedom to do that, because your driveway belongs to you, is the feeling that you have. So it feels that when you are a you, you feel like there are things that belong to you. That's why you tell people, don't waste my time. Whose time? My time. Don't take what is mine. That's my pen, that's my car, that's my hat, that's my house. These are all extensions of a sense of self. Have pity on yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, when you feel that way. And work hard to come out of that. It's worth the battle. That really is worth the fight. It's not worth the fight when you go to your neighbor and you start to give them war and peace or a piece of your mind. It's not worth the fight. You cannot win when you fight against others. The only victory is the one that you've achieved by defeating yourself. So focus your life, whatever is left of the rest of your life, focus that on something worthwhile. You're all still this side of death, aren't you? Right? Let's be fair. You're all still this side of death, which means you still have a fighting chance. For once, let's use the life that we have left to do something worthwhile, to do what's actually right, to do what is right by you. That is what I'm asking you to do. This is a call to awaken you, to do what is right by you. You're paying your taxes, good. You're paying your bills, good. You're doing your jobs, good. Yes, that's all good, but all of that is for others. This call is to do what is right by you. You're a human being. Before you lose that opportunity, before you lose the opportunity to understand the Dhamma, before you lose the opportunity to contemplate the Dhamma and make sense of the world as it really is, do what is right by you. The past is again a creation of the mind. So all those things you're talking about that happened over the course of the past year, you think happened to you. That's why it brings you sorrow. That's why you feel you have a cause for complaint. Because it happened to you, apparently. But it didn't happen to you. Those were just mere chittas. Each arose and passed away. That's it. It arose and passed away. That's it. But when you have a sense of self, that past is your past and the future is your future. So therefore, in this moment of the present, both the past and the future haunt you. They torment you. They take you over. You're hijacked by your past and your future. And then you are miserable. No wonder. I give you hope. You can come out of this. I hope you feel inspired to come out of this. Stop torturing yourself the way you do. You don't need to. Don't create your own pits of suffering. Come out of them because you can. You are blessed, ladies and gentlemen, you are blessed. You are blessed with what is right, you are blessed with the truth. You are blessed with the Dhamma, you are blessed with noble association. You are blessed with noble friends. Embrace that. Make use of that. Make use of this chance and fight it, fight for it until your last breath. This is all that will be worthwhile. When everything is said and done, all that will remain for yourself is what you will have achieved to come out of yourself. That's it. I speak with passion because you are me and I am you. It's not okay for me that I free myself from suffering and you're still in it. If I can be okay with that, then I am the biggest hypocrite in this room. I can't be okay with the fact that although I am freeing myself from suffering, there are yet others who are ankle deep, knee deep, waist deep, shoulder deep, sometimes the whole of them in this pit of suffering. Come out. Raise yourselves up. Push yourselves out. Pick up the courage. Have a determination. Don't resort to using nonsensical, useless avenues to free yourself from suffering. It's pointless doing that. Become someone who throws away your list of complaints. Whatever comes to you is something you've thrown out yourself. Every experience is a mirror of your past actions. Every experience is a mirror of your past actions. If someone decides to kill you, that's because you decided to kill someone. If someone chooses to hurt you, that's because you hurt someone. If someone hurts your feelings, that's because you hurt someone's feelings. If you decide to take something that doesn't belong to you, that's because someone... Or if someone takes something that belongs to you, it's because you've taken something that belongs to someone else. You are the creator of your own destiny. Take ownership of that. Grow up. Not in that way, but mature in a spiritual way. And that will make you feel empowered. Now you are no longer at the mercy of everyone else. You don't have to be. You don't have to go and beg at anyone's feet to give you happiness. You don't have to get on your knees and beg for your happiness from a man or a woman. If you want to get down on your knees in front of the altar, look up and make sure that it is you who's there before you do so. Your present self is wholly responsible for your future self. It's not God's fault that you've had it tough. It's not His doing. It's not His fault. So don't look up and blame. God is fair. Always. Always. He's nothing if not fair. So now it's time for us to take matters into our own hands. Acknowledge that. And throw out that list of complaints. He did this, she did this, he said that, she said that. Put all that away. Don't resort to any of that. And don't listen to people who come and tell you, you should go and talk to them. I'll give them a piece of their mind. I'll tear them a new page. Don't subscribe to those people. Walk away when people come and tell you that it's their fault, his fault, she's her fault, and that you have to do something to them. Walk away from those people. Don't associate with them. At least for the sake of Nibbana, don't associate with them. If you have to do business with them, do business with them, but don't take life advice from them. Don't take life advice from them. Don't. You took, for the last 20 years, you took life advice from them. See where it got you now. You are still looking for happiness. And that's not because they're bad, it's because they are lost themselves. How can a lost man guide another lost man? But you can now. That's why I asked you to become agents of peace. Share this message. Don't share me. Share this message. There's only one of me, but there's 200 of you. Each of you can carry this message. But before you share the message, you have to become the message. How do you become the message? By internalizing it. Become a living, breathing specimen that the Dhamma is true. So, going back to where we started this sermon, people should feel that your presence is a blessing to them. They should want to have you around them. You can be that by growing and maturing in the Dhamma so that you cause no harm or threat or worry to others. So finally, if you can actually internalize this Dhamma and practice it, you can become someone who not only protects others from others, you can become someone who can protect others from yourself, the worst version of yourself. Strive for the best version of yourself. You are already good. You're already good, I know that. There will be levels you will never stoop to again. You're already good. But goodness can also be the obstacle to greatness. So break through from your goodness and strive for greatness. Bon voyage. Okay. Let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today. By making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swaminivas to deliver the sermon, and creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, since throughout the world who have gone to great lengths to protect and preserve the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the Mahanayakas, Yanunayakas, as well as all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries and throughout the world who have made it their life's goal to practice the Dhamma and to protect the Sambuddha Sasana for posterity. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer this message to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in this merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in this merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva as well as all the humans, gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, people who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that in their blood, sweat and tears we enjoy today, the comforts of life that they have so painstakingly made available to us. Let us also transfer this message to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to preserve the peace and harmony of our nation and provide ample opportunity for us to practice the Dhamma. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends to us, people who have done the best that they could do for us. Therefore, with a sense of gratitude towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, say redeem themselves, be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or a Rahat Terunin Mahanse in this life itself and in the era of this Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahan Sangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midetnva Dvesh ginnen midetnva Moh ginnen midetnva Nibbana param sukhayen Sukhita tarvetnva Nibbana param sukhayen Sukhita tarvetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana param sukhayen Sukhita tarvetnva Nibbana param sukhayen Sukhita tarvetnva Nibbana param sukhayen Sukhita tarvetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesh gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapalabeva Nivan sapalabeva Nivan sapalabeva Tunduange Suvisi Ananta Mahaguna Belen Silu Loka Silu Satyavama Nibbana Paramasukhen Suvita Tarvetva Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu.